Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with stories that really matter. And coming up on the program, how a big anti-crime initiative is helping in the fight against ATM bombings. New data shows shifting consumer behavior. Are retailers adapting quick enough? A massive capex investment, but can South Africa's sugar industry survive? And KwaZulu-Natal flooding, municipal negligence is a growing concern. It's Tuesday, the 18th of March. As South Africa looks ahead to the rest of the year, the economic landscape is presenting a mix of cautious optimism and persistent challenges. Now, the MasterCard Economics Institute has just released its much-anticipated Economic Outlook 2025. It offers key insights into GDP growth, consumer spending, inflation trends, and the forces shaping our economy. Here are some numbers for you. GDP growth projected at 1.7%, consumer spending set to rise by 1.9%, and inflation to moderate around 4.2%. So all very mediocre at this point. But the report also highlights some encouraging developments, from improving electricity supply to the potential of tourism revival. Let's try and pull all of this together in a quick conversation. Gabriel Swanepoel is with us, Country Manager for Southern Africa at MasterCard. Gabriel, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Let's start with the big picture. A 1.7% GDP growth obviously sounds better than last year, but nowhere near enough to truly turn our economy around.
Jeremy, thank you very much. Thank you for your time, and hello to your listeners. No, I think you're right. I think it's not what's required, but it's certainly some green shoots to be optimistic about, and hopefully we can see some consumer spending increase at the back of that.
But that GDP growth, though, as we've said, is an improvement, but the concern is still a lag behind the global average, if I'm not mistaken, around 3.1-3.2%. We've still got to deal with structural weakness in this country that prevents us from keeping pace, don't we?
Yes, we do. I think that it's important to call out that even though this initial green shoots are starting to come through, I think some of the fundamental movements that need to take place is a recognition in terms of what broader digitization could potentially do for the economy. I think that there's an important recognition by the banks and other financial stakeholders that the growth in electronic infrastructure and the ability to support small businesses to grow and reach larger markets is important. And I think that these structural changes, you know, could help us get into the 21st century with both feet and help South Africa grow.
Well, let's reflect a little bit on consumer spending, although low, but I guess we take what we can get these days, a projection of around 1.9%. But the reality, Gabriel, is we still struggle under high debt, job loss, rising costs. Do you think this growth is realistic or just wishful thinking?
I think if you look at the growth in terms of the broader e-commerce market, and you know, when we look at it, it's actually been true for the last 5 to 6 years. The e-commerce growth, or the digital online retail sales growth in South Africa, has increased by around somewhere between 27 and 32%, depending on the year that you look, but overall around the 30% mark. And I think what we're starting to see is a shift in terms of, you know, the consumer being able to become familiar and more comfortable with e-commerce transactions. And I think that comes at the base of the structural reform that you mentioned a little bit earlier. You know, we look at things like a more competitive e-commerce landscape with the introduction of Amazon coming into South Africa last year. There's increased confidence amongst consumers that we've spoken to, but also, you know, a much easier interface for people to, you know, be able to leverage these services. We think about, you know, consumers choosing online spending just because of the convenience factor that it affords. And then obviously, you know, everybody knows about the massive success that entities like ShopRite has had with the introduction of 60/60, and what that ultimately does, you know, to meet consumer demand.
I'm wondering if there's a correlation at all between more convenience and the move towards a digital economy has obviously made things easier with a greater propensity to spend. In other words, because it's so easy, we're going to spend more.
I think there's certainly reason to think about that. I think one of the pain points that we've managed to alleviate in terms of lower transaction spending, so think about buying a coffee, is the ubiquity that a contactless transaction now provides you, for example. So if you go into a Seattle coffee company on, you know, any in the morning and you tap your card and you're off with your coffee in 2 minutes, it's certainly more convenient. And the same is true in the online space. I think that increased convergence, you know, coupled to consumer centricity, me being my ability to consume products online when I want and how I want from the comfort of my own home, has certainly, you know, added to that. And I think it goes beyond just the online spending. I think it's also in terms of utility payments. You know, I no longer have to, you know, stand in a long queue, you know, at a retail outlet in order to pay my monthly electricity bill. I can just do it online.
I mean, the reality, though, is there's a certain degree of risk attached to that. You can tap and buy the coffee every single day, but wait until the bill comes at the end of the month.
Yeah, especially depends on your taste. I agree with you.
Inflation, the report says, is expected to moderate around 4.2%. I think that's general consensus. But we also know that food and energy prices do remain high in this country. So I guess the question would be, do you think everyday South Africans are actually going to start feeling any real relief? Or do you think this cost of living crisis is going to persist for the short to medium term?
I think the cost of living crisis is not over. I think that there's reason to be optimistic, but I think that we've got some way to go. You know, I also think that, you know, if you look at discretionary versus non-discretionary spend, people are trending towards making more, let's call it, value-based decisions in terms of spending, as opposed to just decisioning around product purchases. So I think that at the back of that, what we'll see is we'll see, dependent upon how our commercial or economic growth plays out over the next year, we'll see some movement in that space. But I think the specific sector to watch in terms of the spend that will have a rebound and, you know, could contribute to broader economic growth is probably the tourism industry.
Well, let's talk about that. The report rightly points out that tourism is seen as a major growth opportunity. But I always wonder whether we're capitalizing on it enough. That's one. And secondly, we do have crime, visa issues, infrastructure constraints, and that also is going to have an impact on tourism. The big question is, what needs to change urgently for tourism to truly take off?
I think if we look at the formation around the GNU following the elections last year, I think the hope is that there's renewed vigor in order to address legacy visa systems and infrastructure development around that. And I think that if we do manage to make it a little bit easier for people visiting the country, that would certainly take away some of the friction that we've seen in that space and could get us into a positive trajectory for the broader industry itself.
And just a final question. The report points to rising female workforce participation, but at a 0.17% increase since 2019. Gabriel, the truth of the matter is this progress isn't really meaningful, is it? South Africa is still failing in many respects to create real opportunities for women in the workforce.
I think we've got somewhere to go, but I think that we have seen a surge. So South African women are embracing entrepreneurship with growing confidence, with about 57% identifying as entrepreneurs, which if you look at it from a broader regional average, you know, speaking about Eastern Europe, the Middle East and Africa, it's up 57% versus 51%. I think the other thing that's heartening, you know, looking at it bottoms up from a South African and sub-Saharan African perspective, is that the surge is particularly notable among Generation Z women, with 89% expressing interest in starting their own businesses. You know, we've had an initiative in MasterCard where about 5 years ago we committed to bringing 500 million people into the digital economy, and through 350 programs in over 80 markets, we've now met that goal. And what we've done is we've taken a new aim now, which by the end of this year, we aim to include another 500 million people into the formal economy. But in terms of that, 50 million small businesses, we've got to focus there on enabling 25 million of those with women entrepreneurs. So I don't think the point being made is that I don't think it's necessarily just a national problem or a public problem. I think private industry needs to take on the mantle and assist with driving this growth and creating this infrastructure through our women entrepreneurial enterprises as well.
And I appreciate your insights. That's Gabriel Swanepoel, Country Manager for Southern Africa at MasterCard, looking at the Economic Outlook 2025 report, which has just been put out by the MasterCard Economics Institute.
MoneyWeb at midday. Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
South Africa's banking and financial sector is under constant threat from increasingly sophisticated criminal syndicates. In response, the South African Banking Risk Information Centre, we know it better as SABRIC, has launched something called Project Big Bang. It's an initiative aimed at combating financial crime and protecting consumers. So what does this initiative entail? Is it really going to change the landscape of banking security? And I wonder if it's going to be enough to stay ahead of cyber criminals. I'm joined now by Nishal Mewalal, who's Chief Executive Officer of SABRIC. So, Nishal, a very warm welcome. Let's start with the basics very quickly. What is Project Big Bang and why is it suddenly necessary at this time?
Well, let me start off by saying Project Big Bang was launched in response to the alarming rise in the ATM bombings that were happening across South Africa. And, you know, these events were not just causing financial losses, but critical to us was that the number of lives it was putting in danger. I mean, you just think about it. Think most of our ATMs are in malls and in garage forecourts. Can you imagine these things going off and citizens all around there? So our aim of the project was simple. Let's bring the correct guys around the table. And you've already mentioned SABRIC, online intelligence, private security companies, petroleum security initiative, and all of us working as one team. So that was the plan.
So without giving away strategic intent here, how successful has this been so far?
Well, the project has certainly seen some successes already. In the months that have been gone by, we've seen a decrease in around 32% of the incidents that are happening. But the trick has been the collaboration. It's not necessarily about the numbers right now. It's a bit early to measure, but it's been the collaboration. The collaboration has been the game changer in response to the incidents. The trick has been the ability to pool our skills, the unique skills and resources to deal with the criminals.
Had we got to a point, or could we still reach a point where banks are now saying this is simply a no-go area as far as ATMs are concerned because of the security risk attached?
Yeah, look, I think that security and ATMs, the scenario has become quite complicated. It's not possible just to put an ATM up anymore without the necessary infrastructure that's got to support it. So you've got to have the necessary monitoring capabilities, internet capabilities, private security have got to be able to respond to it. So, you know, if we leave it unattended, we're going to find ourselves in a situation where people don't have access to financial facilities anymore. So we've got to do what needs to be done in order to make the different zones safer so that these ATMs can continue staying in place.
The criminal syndicates themselves, I said at the start of this conversation that they have become increasingly sophisticated. What is the intelligence like on who they are and what their modus operandi is?
Yeah, so, you know, keep in mind that banks are traditionally not in the business of intelligence gathering, right? That's the domain of our police services and some private sector outfits. But what we've come to realize is that understanding the incidents and the ability to harness the access to information that all of us have to be able to pool the resources, that is absolutely critical. So there's quite a number of insights that have come out of being able to analyze that data. You know, data that comes out of forensic analysis of cell phone devices or tower information in the specific areas. So there's masterful insights that are able to be used to be able to identify a perpetrator. And that's what this initiative was about, leveraging the access of information we all have lawfully to be able to get the job done.
Given that we are gradually moving away from cash into a more digital world as far as banking is concerned, let me pivot slightly and suggest to you that cybercrime is also evolving rapidly. Do you have a sense of the scale of what it's like right now and whether Sabric is staying ahead of that particular dynamic?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think that's a very interesting pivot, and I like where you're going with this one. Look, our problem has exponentially grown. You've raised this issue at the correct time, and the core risk we face now is the use of artificial intelligence to be able to get people out of millions and millions of rands. In fact, later on, Sabric is going to be speaking about exactly that. And we're not catching up. We're beginning to fall behind because our regulatory processes, our legal processes will certainly never be as preemptive as what criminals are leveraging. So let me give you an example, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure you would have heard of a thing called a deep fake. I'm sure many of the listeners know it. But today, these criminals are leveraging deep fake videos to purport to be bank officials soliciting you into engaging in investment opportunities. And then they are creating counterfeit applications that are on your phone. You download these things, this thing is harnessing the data in your phones itself. So it's become extremely complicated and people are being taken for a song. We have incidents upon incidents that are now known to us and we're looking into it.
So how can the industry stay more preemptive then, given the sophistication of the syndicates as you've just outlined? It would seem to me that this is a war that you simply cannot win.
It's a war which, firstly, this is not a unique thing to South Africa, as we know. It's a global phenomenon. But the trick is we have to begin to modernize the way we are doing these investigations, not just within the banking sector, but in the entire ecosystem. We've also got to think about the way we empower consumers to be able to make their choices when they're about to execute a payment. So it's that. And then we've got to also look at whether we are constructed appropriately from a regulatory perspective and tooled appropriately to investigate these things. It's a completely new world out there from a law enforcement crime combating perspective, and we just need to be able to adapt to the changes, and we haven't adapted as yet.
And part of the problem, and I guess exacerbating the issue, is the lack of capacity or perhaps knowledge of the SAPS in that respect to deep dive into more sophisticated criminal investigation.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, we all understand and know of the financial constraints and the operational priorities of the South African police services. But equally, it's the consumer that is also playing a critical role in understanding what not to do. And our concern here now is that these crimes have evolved to such a point where an ordinary guy is not able to know the difference between what's real and what's fake. And there is no mechanism for them to be able to validate what's going on. Like in a traditional transaction, there are ways in which you can validate whether this is genuine or not. But in this scenario, it's extremely difficult. So there's more investment that's got to be made in terms of how people are able to know what's right and what's wrong. So really, the trick is, if you are receiving these overtures, contact your bank, have that conversation, know whether this is real. Just don't go ahead with things like this.
The warning certainly has been sounded, and not for the first time, but maybe time that we stood up and took a little bit more notice, I guess. Nishal Mewalal, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of the South African Banking Risk Information Centre. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's sugar industry has faced some of its toughest years yet, battling global price declines, increasing imports, job losses, all due to the sugar tax, and also the near collapse of one of its biggest players, Tongaat Hulett Limited. But as the 25-26 sugar season approaches, the company is pushing ahead, investing 460 million rand, there or thereabouts, in off-season maintenance to ensure that its mills are ready. At the same time, the company remains in business rescue. It's a process that has been described as critical to the survival, not just of the company, but the broader sugar industry itself. So my question today is, this investment, is it enough to turn things around? And what does the future look like for South Africa's sugar sector? To answer these questions, Dave Howells is the Managing Director of Tongaat Hulett South Africa. Dave, welcome. Let's start with the basics. This big investment, what does it mean not only for the stability of Tongaat Hulett, but the industry at large?
Certainly the investment that we have spent during this wolf crop, 460 million replicates the spend that we have spent in the last two wolf crops improving our factories. It's a investment, whilst considerable, it really improves the operating performance of our mills. It allows us to be able to crush our growers' cane. And really, that is significant in terms of the efficiencies and the smooth running of the industry and getting the cane to the mills, getting it processed quicker, getting it improved, and ensuring that the cane is processed and fully processed that the supplying growers have. So it really improves not only the performance of Tonga Tulip, but indeed that of our supplying growers. And so it really is a significant investment. As I say, the investment has not only been this year, but the last 2 years as well. Tonga Tulip has spent considerable money, up to 1.4 billion, in getting the mills turned around and improved. The performance has been demonstrated, and we now at a point where we are very confident that the mills this year are going to be able to crush the crop that is there. So it really is encouraging and I think replicates the more buoyant mood that one is seeing in the industry nowadays, building on the efforts of the master plan that we have had in place with government since 2020.
Let's talk about the broader sugar industry in just a moment, but as far as this particular investment is concerned and the specific 460 million rand, is this now going to guarantee some long-term stability as far as the company is concerned, or maybe just delaying deeper financial troubles?
No. You know, the performance of your operating assets is very key to the performance of the business. And what we are seeing is, as we have invested in the last couple of years in the performance of our operating assets, the performance of the business, while still in business rescue, has been significant. And the extra 460 million really will get our assets up to a point where our operating performance will be at a level where we'll be able to perform at a level that will be much improved and significantly improved. Yeah.
As you say, David, over the company has invested 1.4 billion, I think you said, in maintenance over the past three
That's
years.
Right.
But the company still does remain in crisis. Is this a real investment in the future, or simply throwing good money after bad?
Jeremy, certainly the company has looked at the returns that is required, and together with the business rescue practitioners and the investors that have assessed the investment going forward, we believe, they all believe, that it has a very reasonable prospect of returning out of business rescue and into a very much more sustainable future and brighter future going forward. So it is really, in our opinion, a significant investment that will turn the business around.
What does a sustainable future look like for Tongaat Hulett? I think it's fair to say that the sugar industry is struggling. Cheap sugar imports that have been flooding the market, the sugar tax that I referenced a little bit earlier. Are you in a position where you can compete globally?
Yeah, Jeremy, that is a very important question. So the support of government is critical in this respect. The master plan that was started in 2020 was very successful in putting in place certain measures to ensure that the industry is sustained and has certain protections from cheap imports. That is required because the world price of sugar typically trades below that is able to be produced by anybody, any sugar producer in the world market, and those levels of protection need to be in place. All countries, all sugar producing countries in the world have some level of protection, and we are certainly need to have a level of protection from cheap imports. Certainly, in terms of the sustainability of the sector, small-scale growers are a very important contributor to the industry and an important stakeholder. Government recognizes this. Obviously, the provinces of KwaZulu-Natal and Mpumalanga are very significantly important employers, or the industry is a very important employer in the economy, and the government recognizes that. So the support of government is critical. The master plan came up, the first Masterplan 1 ended in last year. There is now a look at how the Masterplan 2, phase 2 of the Masterplan, will renew. We are encouraged by the discussions with all the stakeholders that we have, and I'm very encouraged that as government, together with the other stakeholders, looks forward, we will find a place where certainly we will find protection from cheap imports will continue. Mm. We will find a logical place for an enabling environment for further diversification into other products like sustainable aviation fuel, which is a key focus going forward in phase two of the second master plan. So I'm encouraged by what the master plan offers and the work that is done together with the Departments of Trade, Industry and Competition and Departments of Agriculture and the industry.
Just a quick one in conclusion. It's critical to your point, though, that you explore alternative revenue models or diversifying away from sugar, given global demand is declining and the long-term sustainability concerns that you've referenced.
Absolutely, Jeremy. And there is a lot of work being done by the industry and also together with parts of government to ensure that an enabling environment is created. That's a strong focus going forward. You know, there are a number of industries around the world, such as Brazil, India, Thailand, etc., who have an enabling environment in place for ethanol and other forms where you can take sugar and rather than produce it into crystal sugar, that you then turn it into alternative products. And absolutely, the industry should be able, together with government, where an enabling environment is created, that focus needs to happen. And that needs to, as I say, it's a very strong focus in phase two of the master plan, which aimed to be in place until 2030. Mm.
Dave Howells, thank you very much indeed. He is the Managing Director of Tongaat Hewlett South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, KwaZulu-Natal has become a real ground zero for South Africa's growing natural disaster crisis. From devastating floods to relentless storms, communities repeatedly displaced, homes have been destroyed, businesses have been left in ruins. But while these disasters are inevitable, the impact has been made a lot worse by poor infrastructure, poor urban planning and delayed government response. I guess the question is municipal mismanagement turning natural disasters into financial catastrophes for citizens and insurers? South Africans are already paying for disaster risk management through their taxes, so why are they also being hit with higher insurance premiums when government fails to deliver? I want to put all of that together in a conversation with Inanda Bezuidenhout, Franchise Principal for Short-Term Insurance, Asset Protection and Risk Management at Consult by Momentum. Inanda, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the core issue, if we can. To what extent do you think negligence is making natural disasters worse in KwaZulu-Natal?
Look, it is unfortunately a reality. The infrastructures and municipal mismanagement is contributing significantly to the extensive damages. And I think over the last week, we've had many discussions. And over the last couple of months and years, we've seen the escalation. And when I've been asked, what is the problem? We've established the numerous contributing factors, the failure of the master plan implementation, inadequate risk management and planning, as well as the poor and unplanned urbanization, aging and insufficient infrastructure, and the maintenance thereof. Obviously, environmental and climate changes have got a big impact on those, and the municipal emergency response failures not being in place to adhere to. I think also it is important to understand that the necessity of, whilst I understand the necessity in addressing these and bringing it to light, it's important to understand that risk management and asset protection specialists obviously do have an impact on these, and insurers are taking a knock, unfortunately, because they are having to carry the cost of the of this,
and that inevitably inevitably has a domino effect in terms of premiums, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Many people might not be aware, and I was actually yesterday reminded that there used to be a collaboration before 2008, and what has happened to it? And on February the 19th this year, the MEC for Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs, Reverend Tula Siwe Buthelezi, signed a memorandum of understanding with key partners such as Old Mutual and Santam, the South African Red Cross Society and Al Imdad Foundation to strengthen disaster preparedness and response and to mitigate efforts across KZN, combining the resources and the expertise of both private and non-government sector. And this is what I want to encourage and challenge more insurers to get involved, because I do believe the collaboration and communication is key to success for all of us.
The point that I made at the start of this conversation is that taxpayers already fund disaster risk management through municipal budgets and, as we've discussed, also hit with higher insurance premiums after each disaster. This would signal to me, and maybe a little simplistically, that it's a broken system.
Exactly. Look, it is a double payment dilemma, and the impact that it's got financially on the taxpayer, as well as not just insurance companies, but the insurance companies are funded by you and me contributing towards this pool of funding. And it refers us to the situation where residents are required to pay for the same services and coverage twice. First through the municipal, as you mentioned, the natural disaster and the insurance coverage, and then also in your increasing cost of insurance and self-insured portions that are being implemented and that we are seeing coming through.
So in many cases, Inanda, adding to the problem is disaster relief funding is either misused or even delayed. And one's got to raise the issue about corruption and the role that you think it's playing in the province's inability to respond effectively to natural disasters. What's the problem here?
Look, it is a very interesting question, and I'd love to answer that but as a person, in my private capacity, and also I think from a public representing company, I do think it might be a off-air conversation, to be honest with you. Obviously we can see that government and the municipalities are under extreme pressure when it comes to those mandates and to the funding. There is also behind the scenes the unfunded mandates that they've got to take care of. And that would mean I'll give you an example. Municipalities are faced with underfunded mandates, drawing funds from other areas like roadworks, as an example, as a possible solution when these natural disasters are kicking in to attend to the immediate need. However, it does then leave roadworks unattended to, which is causing a ripple effect in the system.
So the upshot of all of this, unless there is urgent intervention in one way or another, insurers will continue raising premiums in response to rising claims. And the reality is that citizens will continue to unfairly bear the financial burden of government failure at the local and provincial level.
Look, it's not fair nor sustainable. At the end of the day, the piggy bank is going to be emptied. And it does call for serious reformation and accountability measures to be put in place, ensuring that the municipalities in KZN and other regions take greater responsibility for the disaster preparedness and response requires a multifaceted approach. The key reformation and accountability measures need to be put in place. And I do believe it needs to come through capability, through fostering greater collaboration with insurance companies and the government entities. Insurers hold that knowledge. They've got the resources, they've got the procurements to be able to afford the government and municipalities to work with them in terms of these. If we do not start working together now, it is going to lead to a case where, like we've seen with your power surges, a lot of companies have either withdrawn from cover or alternatively imposed bigger self-insured portions, which is your excesses that has been put into place.
So if there are these deficiencies in protocol, as you've mentioned, how is the insurance industry's approach to risk management changing?
Look, from an insurer's point of view, I think the entire industry has become quite to see what is needing to be done. How can we collaborate with our clients in risk management, attending to the problem upfront instead of after the fact? We are seeing increases in premium because it is privately funded. There is no government funding in place, unfortunately. And it's the people that are paying, the minority of people that are taking insurance that are paying for the bigger catastrophes and everything that is supposed to be taken care of by the municipality. So it is unfortunately affecting us in that way. So I do apologize. I can see it coming through with the increase in premiums. Service providers' costs are rising. Unfortunately, it does cost money to repair and replace these, and the consistency of it is affecting insurers.
And that is a very disturbing picture indeed, but some solutions offered. Inanda Bezuidenhout, thank you very much indeed. Franchise Principal, Short-Term Insurance, Asset Protection and Risk Management at Consult by Momentum. Appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that's MoneyWeb at midday for today. We're back tomorrow, live at noon, and then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.